This is Fresh Air. Lane Nishikawa is an actor, but his career hasn't really taken off in Hollywood.
But, you know, you go out there for the auditions and the casting calls, and, well, the only roles for Asian actors in television and film are two-line, two-bit character parts that don't even think. They're waiters that do laundry, you know, or cooks that never learn to ride a horse. Kind of like all the odd jobs I did to keep myself in this business. So I could get up on stage once in a while and play a real-life feeling, thinking human being.
That's from Lane Nishikawa's one-man show, I'm on a Mission from Buddha. He developed it at San Francisco's Asian American Theater Company, where he was the artistic director for 3 years. He's been an actor, writer, and director with the company for more than a decade. The show has been touring around the country for the past 3 years and was adapted for public TV. Nishikawa has also managed to get some roles in film. He appeared in Wayne Wang's Eat a Bowl of Tea, Stephen Okazaki's Living on Tokyo Time, and Wim Wenders' Until the End of the World. In his own play, I'm on a Mission from Buddha, Nishikawa deals with the issues of identity and discrimination, and he talks of his family and how his parents would send him off to school in goofy clothes with a buzz haircut that made it impossible for him to fit in with the other kids.
But my old man did redeem himself, though. That's because he took us to samurai movies when we were young. Yep, every Saturday night, we catch the latest samurai flick of the Toho, and those guys were bad. Nakadai. Kinosuke. Hashizo. That blind dude, Zatoichi. And the John Wayne of our people, Toshiro Mifune, and Mifune was bad. I mean, he would duel it out, right? With 50 bad guys. By himself. At night, in 2 feet of snow, there'd be an arrow stuck in his left thigh. You know, he'd be carrying a small child. His castle burnt down. His father beheaded. His mother sepulchre. Oh, God, you know, it started raining. 70 mile an hour winds. And then the bad guys would cheat. They'd take out guns. No, cannons! He'd lose an eye. His sword would break. But he'd win. Mifune was amazing.
Did American action movies seem tame compared to the samurai movies?
Well, I'll tell you, if you compare some of them, like Seven Samurai, mm-hmm. which is probably one of my favorite mm-hmm. films, and then they made The Magnificent Seven.
Right.
It did lose something in the translation, I think. Sanjuro and Yojimbo were both... came out in the early 50s, and then they came out with Fistful of Dollars, the Clint Eastwood, the gun with no name. Well, Mifune was a sword with no name. And there was something in this figure that I felt never happened with Clint Eastwood. It was a combination of an incredible amount of honor underneath the portrayal of this hired killer. Even underneath it, there was he came from a samurai class, and things like that in the movie were so strong that whereas in Fistful of Dollars, I didn't feel that as much.
Now, when did you want to be in the theater? When did you begin to take theater seriously?
I think I started out basically as a writer in the early 70s out of San Francisco State University. I had a lot of great instructors that showed me a whole different direction with writing called free verse. And with it, we used to go around the different universities, community events, and basically it was a freestyle poetry, storytelling kind of combined. And then I heard of the Asian American Theater Company, and they asked me to audition, and I did. From the first Asian American play I saw, I knew I wanted to be involved with the theater company.
What was it about that first play?
Seeing an Asian American on stage, watching these people go through what I live, feeling their pain and their search for identity and their place in this country. And I thought that, and it was all done in 2 hours in a story that took you from a beginning to an end and gave you some answers but left you with a lot of questions.
My guest on Fresh Air today is playwright and performer Lane Nishikawa. And he's currently traveling the country with his one-man show called I'm on a Mission from Buddha. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Lane Nishikawa, and he's a playwright and a performer. You're a third-generation Japanese-American, mm-hmm. and from watching I'm on a Mission from Buddha, you talk about being more comfortable in the Japanese section of an American city than in Japan itself. What was it like for you to go to Japan and visit there?
Well, Japan, two things were happening. I mean, it was so amazing just to be there and actually feel like everyone else. It's the first time I've ever felt that.
Did you, because you look like everybody else? Because
yeah, everybody looked like me.
Yeah, right.
There wasn't that initial hit of, oh, here comes a Japanese guy. It was just, you know, here comes a guy, which was great.
Although you said you couldn't read a thing when you were in Japan, though.
One of the funniest experiences was visiting my relatives in Hiroshima. And we're at a big family banquet. And they have to attach an interpreter to me, one of my cousins, because my Japanese is so bad that, you know, they didn't want me to, you know, of course, lose face, you know. So they had this interpreter that sat with my sister and I that explained everything. And when I asked the question, it was spoken. So my dad gets up, of course, after a lot of sake and beer, and he says, hey, the relatives want you to do some of your show for them. And I go, are you kidding me? And they go, no, come on, you're an actor, get up and act. And I go, what are you talking about? They're not going to understand a thing I say. He goes, you got a translator? So I say, okay. So I get up and I do this piece from Life in the Fast Lane.
Did they get it?
Well, what I did was I do, 20 seconds, and I'd look at the interpreter, and the interpreter would translate for me. And then they'd look at her. Then they'd look at me, and I'd do another 20 seconds. And then they'd look at her. And they did. They did get it. But it was the most bizarre performance I'd ever done. And, you know, you're talking about my family that goes back probably 16, 17 generations that I never even knew about that were alive. We thought they all died during the bombing in Hiroshima. So it was two things were happening. You know, I'm there at the first time visiting my great-grandfather's land, and then I'm trying to perform for him. I couldn't believe it.
Well, did they talk about the bombing of Hiroshima?
Oh, yeah.
How were they able to survive?
Well, see, that's the story, is that when the bomb hit, Hiroshima is in a valley where there's a mountain range all around the city. And the bomb destroyed everything within that mountain range. My relatives lived on the other side of the mountain. So the radiation didn't go over the mountain. It stayed contained within the valley. And my father didn't find out for 40 years that he had relatives alive. So we finally go visit. And of course, when I'm going there, my mother tells me, one of your uncles has a scar on his face. Don't stare at it. I go, okay, I won't stare at it. So we go there, and you can't help but stare at this guy's face. I mean, half of his face is just scarred, and you wonder, you know, exactly what it is that happened.
Do you know what
happened at the dinner? He says to me, you want to know about my scar? And my mom goes, oh, no, I can't believe that I told you not to stare at him. And I said, I wasn't staring at him. And, you know, I just glanced over there. So he tells me that the story is that he was driving into town to Hiroshima early in the morning over the mountain range. And just as, you know, he got over the mountain, he saw the flash, and he turned his truck. By the time it took him to just turn his wheels, the impact hit his truck, destroyed one side of it, smashed in his window and burned his face, but he was able to turn the truck around.
Wow.
It didn't blow out the tires, and he was able to get back over the mountain.
Is your family bitter at all at America now? I mean, when you go back there to visit?
Oh, no.
Really?
I think that what they are, the first thing you do when you go there, you visit, of course, the family, and you visit the house, and they have what they call Ohaka, the family grave, where all the, you know, Nishikawas are buried. They keep it in a family plot. People with a lot of land usually have a family plot. Then the next thing they do is they take you to the Hiroshima Memorial, because they want anybody who comes there, especially Americans, to see this memorial, not to spread any kind of message of hate. It's to spread a message that this was a really terrible thing, that it shouldn't happen again, that it's really a message of peace. I think Hiroshima does a lot internationally to spread that message. I think Japan, in my feeling, has accepted the loss that they had during the war, and they just moved on with their lives and rebuilt themselves. And I really, you can really see that wherever you go in the country.
America's amazed that anyone could survive the bomb. That 7 out of the 10 largest banks in the world are now based in Tokyo. That anyone could crawl out of the rubble. That multiculturalism means everything they're not. That anyone could survive the Holocaust. That the camps don't mean summertime. That anyone could rebuild themselves stronger. That the dollar has a yen. It's amazing, amazingly simple. Simple methodology goes back for centuries. Nowadays, Cressidas and Maximas are filling garages in American suburbs. Jim McMahon and Grace Jones are selling Hondas. Toyotas are being manufactured in resurrected Georgetown, Kentucky. Oh, what a feeling. Mitsubishi has cut a new deal with Chrysler in Bloomington, Illinois. Yeah, they've come a long way since the aerodynamic World War II Japanese Zero.
Well, you were in Wayne Wang's Eat a Bowl of Tea, and you've been in Living on Tokyo Time, Wim Wenders' Until the End of the World. What kinds of roles were you playing there?
Cooks? No, I'm kidding. it's really
Say it
ironic.
Isn't so.
I tell this big joke about Steve Okazaki about how I can't stand going to L.A. because you just audition for either cooks or waiters or you know, you do somebody's laundry or this or that, and then he cast me in his movie and he cast me as a cook.
Ooh.
I actually played a guy who ran a diner, and it was a nice little role, and it was more where the main character of the picture came in and had his coffee and donuts, and basically instead of having a drink he had, you know, another donut whenever he felt down and depressed. So it was a fun little role.
So it was a cook with substance.
Yeah, it was a nice little moment, couple moments in the film. Actually, I've played paramedics, like in Whoopi Goldberg's Burglars. In Wim Wenders, I played a drug dealer. The last thing I shot that was called So I Married an Axe Murderer, which stars Mike Myers, and it was shot here in San Francisco. And I actually played a Japanese poet, which was kind of nice. It was the first time I was asked to play myself.
You read some of your poetry?
Yeah, I just used my own work. And it was nice just to be able to play myself as opposed to having five meaningless lines, you know.
So what does a poet have to do with So I Married an Axe Murderer?
Oh, he's trying to be a poet.
Okay.
Yeah, Mike Myers is in that whole San Francisco, that beat scene that used to be alive, and these old poets, and he's trying to become a writer, and he's roaming around with this older poet from the 60s.
Do you get a lot of movie offers or you're just very, very choosy? Or?
Well, I'll tell you, I go in and audition a lot, even if the roles are not that large. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of them that came out, and actually I found out a lot of things about myself as I've been auditioning. And a gentleman named Jerry Thorpe explained it to me very clearly one audition about 7 years ago. I was auditioning for this movie called Blood in the Orchid. It was about four Hawaiians who were on trial for beating a naval officer's wife back in the 30s. And the role I auditioned for was for a Japanese lawyer who defended them. He really wanted me to get the role. Jerry Thorpe was the developer and director of Kung Fu. So he had a lot of experience. And he had, what I liked about him, he had a great sensitivity to the Asian American experience or to an Asian experience. I went in and auditioned him first, and he said, Lane, one, your voice is too low. Two, you have a very, and he says, I hate to say it, a very macho quality. You're just too male when you walk in the door. Producers just don't want that.
Well, I'm shocked to hear that.
Then you need to raise your voice, get yourself a pair of glasses, cut your hair, wear a geeky suit and come in, and I'll give you another shot at the role. And I did all of that, and I went in, and I didn't get cast, but that's okay. When I left, he said, I'll tell you this, though, every stage actor would love to have your voice. I wish you the best of luck.
Well, great. Lane Nishikawa, thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Lane Nishikawa's show, I'm on a Mission from Buddha, is still touring around the country. This is a rap song from the show about J-Town, Japantown, in San Francisco.
Now, Niho Machi got sushi to go. Sushi in both fresh Magudo. We got shoujo screens from a Kurosawa dream. Get full Buddha heads, start a bowling team. We got Soka hardware, that's everything you need. From paper lanterns to bonsai trees. Kabuki hot springs, get a quick massage. Underground, last week, all a garage. Go ahead and park, you got a Japanese car. Get your validation at a hostess bar. Got so many kinds of people like you and me. So many kinds of delicious nigiri. We got the best music. Over at Kanzaki, the place to get down is in Nihonmachi.
This is Fresh Air.